Welcome to the Full of Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It's 12:42 p.m. and that is Central Time. Today is August 27th, and I thought we'd kick off with the Fed's balance sheet because it's up from about 7 trillion to 8.3 trillion over the course of the last year. So about a trillion and a bit added to the size of the liquidity that they've been pumping into the market. And Jay Powell was speaking today and saying that they're hoping that they can reduce the number of bonds that they're buying and the money that they're pumping into the system by the end of the year, but that they're in no hurry to raise interest rates. So that was obviously taken as a bullish phenomenon by stock market and commodity investors. And it does raise the question, exactly what are they going to do when the US government sorts itself out and then decides that they're going to continue spending and that deficits are going to continue to rise? And how are those deficits going to be funded? So obviously they could fund them with higher taxes, but that's not particularly palatable. So it's quite likely that they're going to call on the Federal Reserve to continue to buy the bonds that they're issuing. So we haven't seen it yet because there's still the issue of the debt limit, and eventually that, I guess, cumbersome piece of bureaucracy will be overcome probably within the next 6 or 7 weeks. And then we're going to see significant bond issuance. And that bond issuance isn't baked in the cake right now because we don't exactly know how much of it there's going to be, and we don't know exactly what it's going to be spent on. But it's pretty much inevitable that there will be additional issuance. And the balance of money that's sitting with the US Treasury is depleting rather rapidly, and it will reach zero. And it's come in from about $1 trillion to 200 billion, and in the space of just the last few months. So it's not going to be that long before it reaches zero, at which point the debt ceiling is going to become an issue, and then there's going to be a significant amount of media coverage of this whole issue. But it's really just a bureaucratic formality, and once they overcome it, then there's going to be a lot of additional issuance. And there is this debate going on between the populists, who, and of course, this is the big outcome of the last decade, is that populists on the right and populists on the left, the priorities for spending might be different, but they are both more than willing to spend. So this is quite different from what we had in 2012. Because that represented the birth of the Tea Party movement, who wanted balanced budgets, who wanted to try and avoid the mass depreciation of currencies. And it's worth considering that back in 2012, if we look at enough of back history for the dollar, that this, and unfortunately that was a daily chart, so let's look at a monthly chart. That back in 2011 and 12, that's when the dollar started to appreciate. So we don't have a Tea Party movement right now. And therefore, if you don't have the swing factor in the political parties that could sway policy in favor of balanced budgets, well, then the likelihood is that regardless of who's in power, there's going to be more spending. And this is not It's a particularly relevant consideration for the USA right now because the populist wing of the Democratic Party, they really want to remake the economy along in I think in line with their own idealistic way of thinking. So it'll be more focused on spending on social programs, more focused on the environment, and curtailing in or curtailing emissions overall. Of course, it will also represent massive spending and potentially a universal tax on carbon emissions. So those are significant potential factors. So this big spending is obviously one of the significant factors that's relevant for the USA right now, but this is a global phenomenon because we can look at what's happening in the UK. We've had the end of the Brexit is now a reality, and it's now the responsibility of the UK government to deliver on their promises. So they need economic growth, they need higher standards of living, and they are going to have to spend in order to get it. And inflationary pressures are starting to rise. A lot of the inflation, however, has been imported, and a lot of the difficulties, for example, there was a statistic yesterday that car manufacturing productivity, or the number of cars being produced, has fallen to something similar to what it was in the 1960s. This is not about demand, it's about supply. And I've heard from my home back in Ireland last night that the local plant that's manufacturing parts, auto parts, is going to be closing for the next 13 weeks because they just don't have any parts to put together. And so there has been a very significant problem in terms of just getting components to put together to put into cars, and that's having a knock-on effect everywhere. So it's pushing up the price of vehicles, and of course, because we've had very low interest rates and abundant liquidity, it's pushing up the price of property. And so that's certainly a factor that's occurring in the UK. It's happening in Germany too, and then Germany has the additional point that it's likely that even if the Green Party has lost some support of late, that they'll be part of the next government. So it's continues to be likely that there'll be strong support within the European Union for the carbon credits market, and it was at a new all-time high today. It's up to 60 euro and on the way to 100, because 100 is where the politicians want it to be. They want to try and remake the economy there as well. So what we are definitely looking at right now is the predominance of populism in policy making decisions. So that means that there's going to be plenty of additional spending, and the efficiency with which that money is spent is less of a priority for people right now. And there's lots of spending that's going to occur, which means that we'll have to see significant additional printing of bonds and sales of bonds, and then it will certainly be a question of how are those deficits going to be funded. So we're in the reality of modern monetary theory right now. And then on top of that, we also have these ideological priorities that have been introduced, and I don't think it's productive to make a decision about whether they're worthwhile or not. Because obviously there are issues that the globe has right now with, or the global community has, with global warming, with the guilt attached to economic development in the past, and particularly relative to the full impact of climate change being felt by poorer people everywhere. So there are lots of ways of interpreting this, but none of them point towards the or anything other than a requirement to pay. So we're going to be paying in terms of guilt, and we're going to be paying in terms of treasure, and we're going to be paying in terms of loss of living standards, because when we think about carbon credits and the costs that are being imposed, well, again, this is also in many respects populist in nature, because it requires a great deal more spending, less consideration of the overall cost and implications for the wider economy, because there is a clear I think determination that something needs to be done. But in fact, what I think most people are starting to think now is that anything needs to be done. And what that is also pointing towards is less efficiency and greater costs. So these are inflationary in pressure. When economies become less efficient and when governments spend more than they have, and when there's less respect for balanced budgets and fear of inflation has largely disappeared, well, then that is exactly the kind of conditions where we do start to get inflationary pressures rising. So I think that's one of the more important considerations around right now. And this is particularly relevant for Europe. It's particularly relevant for the UK and for the USA. So these are significant sources of additional new liquidity entering the market. And this, I think, is one of the big questions because the majority of media commentary is focusing on what central banks are doing and less on what governments are doing. But and then, of course, there is the question of just how independent are central banks? And will central banks stand up to governments and say no, that you can't go off and borrow all this money, we're not going to buy it, and that bond yields will have to rise meaningfully? And I don't think that there's just any real threat of that. Because central banks know. In fact, central banks have been encouraging governments to spend more. And they've been doing that for most of the last decade. And now that the various governments around the world are in fact spending more, well, they can't just turn around and say, no, you're not doing that right. So bond yields pulled back from the lower side, excuse me, the upper side of their range in here today on the potential that the Federal Reserve is going to continue buying over the next few months. So it's avoided the continuation of this recovery overall. Nonetheless, this is still a range, and as long as the lows around 1.2% are holding, it's still the beginning of a new uptrend. But we could be ranging for a while. But then we have to, I think, just think about the longer term, because governments now have changed their minds. They have completely abandoned the outlook that they really should be looking at fiscal austerity. And this is particularly relevant for Europe because fiscal austerity was a major factor in the underperformance of assets in Europe over the course of the last decade because it was largely deflationary and it contributed to subpar growth and a lack of liquidity to fuel asset price inflation. The one area that did particularly well was property because of low interest rates and negative deposit rates. So that was certainly a big factor. But now Europe is breaking on the upside and it has completed a very lengthy range. So we have to go back and look at more than 20 years of history to put this range in full context. And it's another example of a market that was on the cusp of breaking on the upside ahead of the pandemic, then got knocked back in a very significant manner, and is now pushing on the upside. So this looks like a new bull market. And the big headwind for European asset prices was fiscal austerity, and fiscal austerity is over. When we look at what's going on in Germany, where the automotive companies are rapidly migrating towards electric vehicles, and the implications that has for the mid-sized companies that have prospered for decades on supplying automotive parts, well, if there the reality is that electric vehicles have got probably only about 30% of the moving parts of an internal combustion engine driven car. So just by that fact alone, they require fewer parts overall. And that's going to have a big knock-on effect for a significant portion of the European economy, where the automotive sector represents national champion and very large employment bases for Germany, France, and Italy. And this is going to be a sector which experiences a great deal of flux over the course of the next decade. And the number of electric vehicles being sold continues to trend higher. Well, a couple of years ago, it was a tenth of a percent. Now it's up to about 1 to 2% of vehicles being sold. And that's going to trend higher over the course of the next few years because the number of models that are going to be released is going to trend higher and take a more dominant position in the product offering, at least from 2023. So when we look at the outlook for companies like Daimler, well, they may start producing more of their products in-house, and the share is right in the region of the trend mean right now. But it's also worth just putting this into the context of the longer term, and we have this extraordinarily lengthy range, and the price is now right at the upper side of that range. When we look at Volkswagen, well, we got to look at the preference share because of the big spike that occurred in the regular share during the credit crisis, but it's now right in the region of the peaks from back in 2015 and steadying from the region of the trend mean. As we enter a point in Europe where Angela Merkel is exiting her position and where there is a lot of flux in the political system, there's these challenges that are arising because of the idealistic policies that have been introduced with regard to climate change and emissions and clean air. Well, then all of that is going to contribute to a dislocation for the population. And on top of that, you have the impact that many people will attribute to climate change from the floods that we had in Germany this year. So that will also require a lot more spending. So there is the very realistic possibility that what we're looking at in terms of European markets breaking on the upside is that Europe has, in fact, now transitioned into a fiscal laxity environment, and it will be led in many respects by Germany. So, Germany has had a really benign effect on the wider European economy in terms of their borrowing because we still have negative yields. But if Germany is going to abandon fiscal austerity and is willing to run even a modest deficit, then that will also and encourage other regional governments to push upon the limits imposed by the euro. So it's likely that we're in a competitive currency devaluation environment. The ECB is not going to raise rates anytime soon, and they are unlikely to taper anytime soon either. They're going to be behind the curve relative to everyone else. So the dollar has been reasonably firm of late, and it was weaker in here today. And I certainly, when we look at the quantity of debt that is about to be issued in the USA and the pressure that will be brought to bear on the Federal Reserve to keep buying it, well, there's going to be a lot of supply of dollars. And Europe is also going to be supplying currency, but perhaps not quite at the same rate as the USA. So this is emblematic of a competitive currency environment. So nobody wants a strong currency, and countries are competing against one another to weaken their currencies. And this also is particularly relevant for China. So China has been, and this is one of the the challenges for a centrally governed economy, that when they ease up on everything. When they tighten up on everything, because there is the capacity for knee-jerk decision making. So inflation's getting out of the way. Okay, let's fix this. So let's cut off the liquidity to the property market. Let's raise deposit rates at the banks and reserve requirements at the banks. Then let's lean on the most speculative portions of the market, whether that is the property markets, the banks, the property developers, or the tech sector. Let's lean on all of them and make sure that money only goes to the sectors that we want it to go to. And let's just close down any agency that is flouting some of these rules. So that's certainly what we've had in China over the course of the last year. And all of that happens in the normal course of affairs, but generally it's less evident, but it's been exaggerated this year because of the pressure that's come to bear as a result of dealing with the pandemic. Now we're looking at a very significant appreciation that we've had in the renminbi, and this trend is losing momentum. And then China has got a significant drawdown that has been evident in the largest companies. Alibaba, I guess, is one of those. It's pulled back extremely violently, and now the big question is, are we in the region of a low? Has the market got the capacity to bounce again from this area? It's likely that China is now starting to think, well, they might have leaned a little bit too heavily, and having locked down half the country, there is certainly an economic impact in terms of that. They have been looking at the rest of the world and thinking, well, they're printing a great deal of money. Perhaps we're not going to be the ones that massively shoot out our leverage ratios on this occasion. And they hope that they'll come through this with a competitive advantage. But the question is, how much pain are they willing to take in terms of the economy and markets before they can actually achieve their goals? And so it is looking likely that the liquidity is about as tight in China as it's likely to be, and there is the scope for some additional easing. And the loss of downward momentum for the dollar relative to the renminbi suggests that China will be more interested in devaluing their currency going forward in order to supplement the support that's going to be required for the wider economy. And this is, of course, relevant as well because of inflationary pressures. Europe has got higher inflation than they've had in a long time, and some of that is being imported. Then the Chinese banking sector has bounced over the last 3 weeks, but was negative in here this week. It really does need to hold that 14,000 level. In many respects, the banks are just arms of the government, and their underperformance is representative of the liquidity that's been drained out of the market. So when we think about the outlook for fiscal austerity, well, in many respects, China has been engaged in some form of austerity over the course of the last 6 to 8 months. They've been draining liquidity out of the system. They've been trying to curtail speculation, and now it's resulting in slower economic growth. And then you had Xi Jinping in here this week saying that they intend to hit their targets in terms of growth. Well, it's going to be very difficult to do that if they don't have a lot of liquidity in the market. So we're also potentially on the cusp of China turning around and beginning to support asset prices overall as well. And the reason that all of these factors are important is that stock markets and asset prices generally are extremely liquidity dependent. So we're up to central bank balance sheets now in the order of about 31.8 trillion. And this remains a bull market. And as long as we continue to see this tide of liquidity continuing to rise, well, then there's not really going to be anything to worry about in terms of the consistency of trends. But we can also then just go back and look at what happened at the beginning of 2018. All the way through 2018, the size of central bank balance sheets contracted. So that represented a limiting factor on asset prices, and we had a much more volatile trading environment overall on the big stock markets. And if you just think about what happened in the S&P 500, we had this incredibly consistent and persistent advance from late 2016 through to the beginning of 2018, and subsequently we went into a much more volatile environment in 2018, and the market was up and down a lot, but finished down on the year for the first time in quite a while. Now we have an even more impressive advance in 2020 through 2021. It's also on the back of abundant global liquidity and the potential that we're going to start to see liquidity ramping up again because debt spending in the USA, fiscal or the abandonment of fiscal austerity in Europe, and then the potential for liquidity and the credit impulse to turn the corner in China, they all point towards abundant additional liquidity, which is why the stock market continues to rise here. And the VIX index continues to trend lower. But then I think this was one of the most impressive charts that I've seen in really what feels like an awfully long time, because it's a chart of Bitcoin, and it's not something that you see all that often. So my computer is lagging. It's taking a while to pull this over. This type of spiral chart, it's in a log scale. So what it looks at and the look back period, so one circle represents 4 years, and in every 4 year period we've seen that prices have tended to go up in an order of magnitude. So 10 to the 2, 10 to the 3, 10 to the 4, and now we're in this next circle. So then the last, when it first got to 10,000, that was in approximately 2016, or excuse me, 2018. Then we got to there's the potential that if this trend continues, although I think it is particularly relevant that the pace of the advance has been decelerating because otherwise it would be coming through this concentric circle and it's pulling down from it. So certainly we've had a deceleration, but it will be looked at from another perspective by the bulls that if you had held Bitcoin for 4 years, it doesn't matter when you bought it, you always made money. So I think that's important because it's going to be used as a rationale for buy and hold. It's going to be used as a rationale by people that it doesn't matter when you buy as long as you hold on. And as long as you hold on for 4 years. Well, I think that's a very important component in any big bull market because I've seen exactly the same argument being used in terms of technology stocks and copywriters and marketers using the example that if one had bought Amazon in 2000 and held on, well, then it just didn't matter how or at what point you bought it, you would be in the money now. And of course, that makes empirical sense to anyone when they look at what the price was around $100 back in 2000, and they look at the price today at $3,300. Well, then obviously, then you are encouraged to simply buy and hold, and that as long as you have the time, you'll always make money. So these are the kinds of rationales that come through in the third psychological perception stage of a bull market. Now, the most important thing, and the reason that I wanted to talk about liquidity first, is that bull markets don't end because of a lack of demand. They end because supply increases and liquidity decreases. So we're in an environment today where liquidity is increasing and supply is increasing because we have a succession of companies that are going to IPO either in the traditional manner or through the SPACs. So the supply of shares is rising. There is absolutely no question in that. And then this creation of a special purpose acquisition company and how they are being created so that it limits the downside for investors because there is an assumption that bond yields can't rise in a big way. And so far, that has proved correct. So it's encouraging more money to move into private assets. And of course, we have to also just remind ourselves that private assets are extraordinarily interest rate sensitive. And the price of those assets has been rising in a very significant fashion. So we're at a point today where the amount of money that is pouring into the private equity sector has increased substantially, and that the prices that these private companies are achieving has multiplied over the course of the last year. So the average price now is over $900 million for a late stage venture backed company, and just 18 months to 2 years ago, it was more like 300 million. So we're seeing a lot more money flowing into this sector. We're seeing a lot more speculation in IPOs because this is exactly what happened in the 1990s. There was a clear strategy deployed by retail investors that all you had to do was buy IPOs and you couldn't lose money. And today, that exact same argument is being made about the SPAC sector, that the way that they've been structured, it insulates you from losing money, and you still have the optionality on the upside from the performance once an attractive acquisition has been made. So that's driving this significant appreciation in the valuations of private companies because the SPAC investor is desperate to make the acquisition and capture the upside. And money continues to flow into the sector. So there is this continued evolution in terms of the appreciation of a major bull market, that rationales continue to arise that make the compelling case that it doesn't matter what price you pay. You will definitely make money. All you need to do is to be invested. And anyone who's been to the chart seminar will remember these types of conditions because this is exactly what happens in the third psychological perception stage of a bull market, that it no longer means that the argument in terms of compulsion, that it's not just a simple matter of investing any longer, that you have to be invested because you can't possibly avoid the loss of opportunity, that inflationary pressures are starting to rise. So Interest rates are still extremely low, so you are literally losing money by not being invested. And then when you look at the history and the fact that we are in an environment where all you have to do is own it and you are guaranteed to make money, well, these are extraordinarily compelling ways of encouraging investors out of cash and into assets. And it is also representative of the argument that valuations don't matter. But of course, we know that valuations do matter. But then the question, of course, is when do they matter most? Well, they matter most when liquidity is less available and interest rates begin to rise. But we are not there yet. So that suggests that we are still in the inflating portion of this bubble. And it is a bubble because we're certainly seeing every condition met to suggest that investors now understand what the rationale for investing is, and they're going out the other end and thinking that it can never end. So this is emblematic of the bubbly environment. And the most important thing about a bubble is that this is when you get the most consistent trends, because it will look like He-Man. And perhaps that might not be a relevant consideration or a relevant comparison for many subscribers. So He-Man was a cartoon when I was a child. Mr. Muscle might be another way of thinking about it. It will look like Mr. Muscle until it eventually looks like Mr. Bean. And that's unlikely to happen until we, in fact, start to see interest rates rising and liquidity being withdrawn. So we're nowhere near that yet. And the kinds of things that we would monitor for outlooks in terms of liquidity are not red. The yield curve spread has at least paused around the 100 basis point level, but it's not surging higher. And we can just zoom in and look at that on a daily basis. So it certainly steadied around 100 basis points, but it is not surging higher. The yield curve spread is a very significant lead indicator for future recessions. High yield spreads have popped on the upside, but they are not looking problematic. And they will not look problematic until they are surging through 500 basis points. So we are still a long way from that. When we think then about what's likely to do best, well, the Nasdaq continues to represent where a lot of money is getting pushed into, and it continues to advance. So this represents a very significant trend. We're seeing Europe playing catch up. We're seeing Japan also playing catch up. And the Nikkei is right in the region of the trend mean right now. But what we are also now starting to see is that investors are beginning to look at hedges against outright currency devaluation. And gold was up in a reasonably dynamic manner in here today, and it has cleared the $1,800 area, and now it is testing the highs from back in July. One thing that I like, and I most particularly like about gold right now, is that there has been a cacophony of traders saying that they've sold their gold and that the bull market is over. And a lot of them probably got stopped out on that big decline that we had 2 weeks ago. But the reality is gold broke out in 2019, and it had a stab lower in 2020 during the pandemic. And then it rebounded in a very significant fashion and got up to a new all-time high. Now, back in August of 2020, I sold my leveraged positions in gold, and I had a lot of pushback from subscribers saying, "How could I possibly do that? Didn't I understand that this was a, didn't hadn't I been saying for so long that this is a new bull market? How could I possibly be selling?" But anyone who's ever traded gold knows that when it accelerates, then it doesn't accelerate forever. And generally speaking, after the accelerations, you do move into a much more choppy environment, and you will get bargain opportunities. And we were presented one with a bargain opportunity 3 weeks ago, because what you get in gold is people trying to test where demand is starting to come back in. There's always going to be people that want to trade inside the range, and they'll do so in size. So that's exactly what happened 3 weeks ago. And of course, there was also this worry about the outlook for tapering and what that was going to look like and whether the dollar was going to continue to rally. But if we are in fact looking at the outlook for inflation and higher inflation to be tolerated by central banks and governments, and abundant liquidity and just a willingness to spend, well, that represents competitive currency devaluation, and it's an environment in which gold can prosper. And this, to me at least, looks like a medium-term consolidation. The thing that I find most interesting is the synchronicity that we have with the gold price from back in the early 2000s, because we had the very big pop on the upside in 2016. We had approximately a 3 year range and a breakout and a pullback into the region of the upper side of the range, and then a big pop on the upside and a very volatile range subsequently. Then, if we just go back and look at what happened in 2000, well, we had the big pop on the upside. Then, about 3 years later, we had the breakout. We had a pullback into the upper side of the underlying range, and then a significant advance and a very choppy range subsequently. So, if that's the case, well, it would be quite likely that I think this was the period of disbelief. All this period from about 2004 through to about 2008 was the acceptance phase of that bull market. And then we had the very consistent advance. And gold went from being a very inconsistent trend with very lengthy ranges, accelerations, and big drawdowns into a very rhythmic trend between about 2009 and 2011, and then it accelerated right at the end. So this then was towards the end. This was the disbelief phase in the bear market. We got the acceptance phase in the bear market, and now we're back in then all the way back to 2016 through to 17 and 18. That was disbelief in terms of the new bull market. And I think this acceptance phase might last another few years. So we might just see the gold price popping on the upside and perhaps even accelerating higher for a while and then moving into another volatile range. That I think this argument and the chart for Bitcoin, where the estimates are that the price will get to 100,000, then 1 million and 10 million. Well, these are extraordinarily high numbers. So we're definitely approaching the law of large numbers, and it's going to be progressively more difficult to achieve these goals on a 4 year rolling basis unless we have hyperinflation and massive money printing. But the way things are going, you can't rule it out, because governments are terrified of restive populations. And the reality is that globalization and quantitative easing haven't worked for most people. So we're getting these social revolutions. And this is a secular theme. It's something that's likely to be in something we're going to be wondering about for an awfully long time. So when we then think about how is Bitcoin doing? Well, I think that gold is cheap and it has got a significant potential for additional upside. Bitcoin has continued to rebound and it has one range here which had an amplitude of approximately $5,000. The next range had an amplitude of approximately $5,000, and then this range is about four, and it's found support. And I guess there would be a midpoint danger line in the region of about 45,000. So it is at least finding support in the upper side of the underlying trading range. We're definitely going to have the reality of additional significant liquidity provision in order to supplement the uptrend in Bitcoin. So I do anticipate that we're going to see news on that front before the end of the year, and that should support asset prices within the cryptocurrency markets because they are a pure liquidity play. I don't believe that this is anything to do with the efficacy of the bullish argument with regard to how they're going to remake the economy or anything approaching that. When we simply think about price, then it's a liquidity play. It's not necessarily about whether this is a safe haven or a risk asset, but it's just a pure liquidity play. The more money that's printed, the better they'll do. And when less money is printed and we move into a higher interest rate environment, then this is, I think, also just if we think about the inflation we've had in private assets, well, cryptocurrencies are also private assets. And they're a mechanism through which people can express a view. And cryptocurrencies had their genesis in the aftermath of the credit crisis, where people were looking at the potential for alternatives to fiat currencies. So now we have this continued advance in Bitcoin and Ethereum starting to firm within its range as well. And we have certainly also got the potential for greater inflationary pressures because of all this liquidity that's been printed and the supply chain difficulties that we have. And then there are obviously the geopolitical components that can contribute to inflationary pressures, whether that is the increasingly taut trading environment with China and the determination of the controllers of global supply chains to ensure themselves against the potential that this situation with China is going to end in an unruly fashion. Oil prices, despite the fact that the green movement would rather not talk about it, continue to rebound. There is obviously then the additional point right now of Hurricane Ida making landfall in Louisiana on the anniversary of Hurricane Katrina, and oil prices are rallying on the back of that. 12% of the U.S. production originates in the Gulf of Mexico, so they are abandoning or they're evacuating oil platforms in the Gulf of Mexico right now. It's less of a factor for natural gas production, but it is a factor in terms of the natural gas processing. And the big export facilities are in Louisiana. The Cheniere, let me just put that up. The Cheniere, oh golly, I'm not typing very effectively. Energy Partners, their facility is in the Louisiana Basin, This is also breaking out, and natural gas prices are rallying through the $4 area for the first time in a few years. So there's certainly the scope here that there's going to be some additional commodity price inflation on the back of not just a somewhat weaker dollar in the short term, but also because of supply disruptions owing to hurricanes. One thing that has been particularly relevant for hurricanes over the course of the last 18 months has been that they have strengthened in an extremely abrupt manner in a very short period of time as they approach land. So, yesterday, Hurricane Ida was circulating at 40 miles an hour. Today, it's at 115. And it's expected to be a Category 3 hurricane by the time it makes landfall in late Sunday or early Monday morning. So there's certainly the potential that it's going to create additional upside potential for both oil and natural gas. And then there's also a lot of soybean processing facilities in that area as well. So we're seeing spreads between futures contracts moving higher. But so far, the soybean price hasn't been up in an especially dynamic manner. There's obviously then, if this is a change, and there's been a lot of discussion in academic circles about whether this abrupt strengthening of hurricanes, which has been evident over the last year and a half, is a statistical anomaly, or whether it is a symptom of climate change. That's a very big consideration because it increases the costs of dealing with these types of events. And obviously, if they are more severe, it makes it rather difficult to live in the kinds of areas that are very low-lying around the Gulf Coast. So it also represents an inflationary outcome, because it will represent an additional cost which makes the economy less efficient. And less efficient economies which require more money and rising costs overall create the perception of inflation. So it does suggest that we're in a more inflationary environment, that some of the factors are going to be transitory in nature, and certainly the supply chains that are affecting the automotive sector are probably going to be transitory in nature. When Taiwan Semiconductor put on a 20% cost increase yesterday on their components, well, that is also representative of inflation, but there will be additional supply coming through from the semiconductor sector as well. So that's still a cyclical sector, and prices will come back down again. But so far, the semiconductors sector, having lost momentum over all of this year, it has continued to push on the upside, and it was up in a dynamic manner in here this week. So this is also suggestive that liquidity will help to support this price as well. So I think the big conclusion is that we're in the inflationary portion of the market. We're still in an inflating bubble overall, and that prices can go up further and faster than anyone really thinks possible during the bubbly period. And the thing to be particularly cognizant of is that losses of consistency in that kind of environment are something that should be taken seriously, because you should get the most consistent trends in the bubbly phase. And then one thing that is particularly worth considering is that the advanced decline line is something to pay attention to during the bubble. So it's been going sideways for the last 3 months. And when we think that's the advanced decline line for the New York Stock Exchange, So it's at the lower side of the range right now, and the New York Stock Exchange index is at the upper side of its range. Well, divergences, and generally divergences arrive more than a year ahead of a major top in the market. But this divergence that we're seeing today is representative of a narrowing of breadth. So you do get a narrowing of breadth in a bubble because the number of companies that can really respond to the animating force of the bull market narrows. So the Fangman index is now pushing on to new all-time highs, and it is representative of a very significant portion of the overall market. We're talking about seven companies that represent a market cap of over 10 trillion. And this is still a bull market, and it has not peaked. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend and wish all the best to all of you.